Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. On this New Year's episode, we hear of a new book examining the life and academic contributions of Terence Cole.
He really is a narrative historian and has always emphasized the story because that is what differentiates humans from every other animal. It's that we tell stories and we relate to history and we draw meaning out of stories. So he's a great storyteller, both in his teaching style and in his writing style.
Mary Erlander talks about the big wild soul of Terence Cole, and we revisit a conversation with Terence and his twin brother Dermot about life today and their sometimes unique upbringing.
After church on Sundays, we would have to box in the living room with a makeshift boxing ring. It was just, I still can't believe it. This just was his idea of parenting.
I hope you'll join us. Last month, the University of Alaska Press issued a collection of essays called The Big Wild Soul of Terence Cole, saluting the recently retired UAF history professor. Northern Soundings reviewer and UAF English professor emeritus Frank Sose co-edited the volume called A Festschrift. The other editor is Dr. Mary Erlander, UAF history professor and co-director of the Arctic and Northern Studies program. She enjoys a unique status, having studied with Cole and then becoming his colleague, including teaching with him on several occasions. While she was out of the country, I phoned Mary to ask about the volume and what her first memory of Terence was.
I believe it was in 1988 when I took a U.S. history class from Terence. That was the first time that I met him. And I have such a clear image of him to this day. I can picture sitting in that class. I remember the room. I believe it was Greening 202 downstairs. And I just found him so engaging. And my three boys were in grade school, junior high, and high school at that time. And I remember thinking, oh, if only all my boys' teachers could be just like this. I mean, to me, it was impossible that a student could be disinterested in history with a teacher like that.
Sometimes with academics, you're writing for your colleagues, but it seems like Terence's ability was to tackle serious subjects, but he always seemed to have the public in mind. Would that be right?
Yes, I would certainly say so, both in his lecture style and in his writing style. He had just a magical, almost, way of engaging the public. I remember so well that his lead-ins, it was almost like journalistic style a little bit, because he always wanted, you know, a really powerful first line in the article or in the book. And he really focused on being both engaging and accurate and in carrying that narrative along. So he, in his writing and his publishing, he really is a narrative historian and has always emphasized the story because that, as he has said to our students, that is what differentiates humans from every other animal. It's that we tell stories and we relate to history and we draw meaning out of stories. So he's a great storyteller, both in his teaching style and in his writing style.
I understand you helped organize what's called a festschrift. First off, it's really a volume of essays by colleagues of a particular academic where they salute his contributions. Do I have that right?
Yes, and they can take different forms. Typically, they include a selection of essays on topics that address issues that scholar addressed. And so in our case, all of the articles have to do with Alaska. It's a very interdisciplinary volume. So there's history in there. We have political scientists contributing. We have an artist. We have English professors. And so it's mostly social sciences and humanities on a variety of topics, but all about Alaska. And at the beginning, we have actually four essays that are really about Terence himself. One I wrote about his teaching and service, and one Jerry Macbeth wrote about his contributions to Alaska history scholarship, and one his twin brother Dermot wrote, about parents as a brother, and then one Ron Inouye wrote about parents as a colleague and as an Alaska historian. The other articles are written by several former students of Terence's, as well as longtime colleagues of Terence's, on a variety of topics, all relating to Alaska.
You know, that's so interesting, because I think about lectures where he's combined with, for example, Kes Woodward about an art historical perspective, and Terence and Jerry Brigham, who used to be general manager here, co-teaching a class on Alaska cinema. Mm. So it seems to me one of the gifts that Terence has is his ability to partner with other professors in other disciplines to give a broad, multidimensional approach to his subject.
Absolutely. Yes, he has collaborated with others, and he is such a multidimensional scholar, you know, because he does know film and he knows about the written word. And so in that way, he takes a multidisciplinary approach to his work and to his teaching, which makes it all the more engaging for students.
Given the broad collaborative basis that Terence has with many of his colleagues here at the university, how did you go about approaching who to tap for the Festschrift?
Actually, Frank Sos came to me about the project, and I immediately jumped on it and was just delighted to be a part of it. And so we thought about who would like to be included, and we came up with quite a long list of former colleagues in a variety of disciplines who are in Alaska and outside Alaska now, as well as a number of his former graduate students, several of whom have gone on and earned PhDs and are active historians. And so we compiled this list and then contacted each one of them. And it was just astonishing how quickly people responded and said, oh, I would love to be a part of this. We had, I think, only one person say, oh, I would love to, but I'm so sorry, there's no time in my schedule. In the end, we had a couple of more contributors or people who intended to be contributors who just could not pull it off under the time constraints that we had, because we were moving on a pretty quick schedule on this project. And so the contributors are a collection of former colleagues and current colleagues and former students. So it's a Festschrift or Festschrift. I'm not totally sure about the pronunciation, but it really has been, the work has really been sort of a, you know, a love fest for Terence, of honoring him and acknowledging the extraordinary contributions he's made to Alaska history.
Mary Erlander, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Mary Erlander teaches history at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and also serves as co-director of the Arctic and Northern Studies Program. Links to UA Press and The Big Wild Soul of Terence Cole can be found at northernsoundings.com and the Northern Soundings page at kuac.org. When we return, we revisit with Terence and his twin brother Dermot in a conversation I had with them last year. This is Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Over the years, I've interviewed Terence and Dermot separately on various occasions, but last spring was the first time I had a chance to talk with them together. Anyone who has heard them and their late brother Pat Cole on KUAC's Any Old Time will know a lot of humor and non-sequiturs find their way into the exchanges. That was my experience in our conversation. The discussion was prompted by Terence's retirement from UAF and the birth of Dermot's blog. In honor of the Festschrift just published, I combined the two parts of my conversation from last spring for this New Year's edition of Northern Soundings. I originally began the discussion by asking the twins how they got to Alaska.
Pat came up here with Terence in 1970. Really, because Pat wanted to get away from Philadelphia. He had been a freshman at Temple University, and he got beat up one day at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was mugged, and he was in the hospital for several days. And
it wasn't a very profitable mugging.
Though he was very frugal. They got a few dollars from him, but anyway, that really cemented his view of getting away from there.
That and the concussion.
Yeah, and he did have a concussion. He got hit with a steel pipe, if I remember right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Holy smokes, that's serious.
Yeah, I mean, it was a serious attack. You know, he said many times that he went to the college library to determine where he would go next, and that he began going through college catalogs, and he started with A, with Alabama. And Alabama didn't...
ruled out Alabama.
He didn't like the idea of Alabama. Then what comes next is Alaska.
It's a good
and
thing
now it's a good thing he didn't skip to Arkansas right
exactly.
away.
Exactly. Yeah, Arkansas.
Anyway, so he went to Alaska, and at that time, UAF was a good bargain, I think, as it is today, frankly. And he looked at the out-of-state tuition and what he could afford and, you know, hatched this plan coming up here. So he came up here with his girlfriend, Joyce Mann.
And
from,
Terrence.
And
well,
Terrence.
No, they, I was the substitute for the girlfriend because she couldn't come, so he had somebody had to ride in the truck with him. So,
but Pat and I drove up here in his old in his
pickup and that camper, and we took 10 days and came up here in 1970.
What was the trip like, Terrence?
You know, it was really interesting. We drove up through Canada, and you know, shows how dumb we were. We picked up these two young hitchhikers, and we ended up getting stopped by the Mounties because they were runaways. Look, that was our experience with Canadian justice system.
But in those days, everybody picked up hitchhikers. It was a much more common thing. And in fact, they were just driving by UAF and stopped, and there was a guy hitchhiking at the top of the hill.
Ninana. He was going to Ninana.
Young guy about the same age as Pat, with bright red hair, and he hopped in the back of the truck. This was David Bear, who became Pat's best friend in Fairbanks until Pat's death in 2013. He was his best friend here.
So. Yeah.
Terrence, what were your first impressions when you got here?
I loved Alaska, and I thought, okay, I want to come back here.
What was it about Alaska? Because you guys were raised on a farm, right?
Yeah, we were raised on a farm.
In southeastern Pennsylvania. It was 40 acres, maybe.
Well,
that's substantial.
Yeah. Well, it was a sort of a...
Gentleman farm?
It was a non-working farm in the sense of...
Yeah. The lazy
man's farm. Child labor. There was a lot of child labor at this farm. But we did learn the farm stuff, and I, you know, we had a garden. Starting when we were small kids, we were allegedly paid for getting rocks out of this garden. I can't remember actually how many pennies were involved, but...
The Irish vision of a great garden, all those beautiful rocks.
Ooh. Yes.
I know both of you obviously have strong literary careers. Oftentimes I find people who are drawn to that have rich stories in their upbringing. Were stories, literature, history important?
Our dad's vision for his children was to all the boys to become engineers. Which didn't work.
Well, because he was an engineer. Except he wasn't.
He wasn't dogmatic
about it. Sold on that. I mean, he believed he should get a college education. He was a tough character in some ways, you know, and our, you know, thought we weren't tough enough. So after church on Sundays, we would have to box in the living room with a makeshift boxing ring. It was just, I still can't believe it. This was his idea of parenting. So
our dad was a... He
fervently believed in education.
And so he really did sort of applaud because Pat went into law, our brother Kevin into computers, and Dermot and I, you know, became writers. But our two sisters both became more scientifically oriented than we ever were.
And business.
But yeah, so we really did have it was great, encouraged by our parents, and our house was always filled with books. It was a little bit difficult because our mother died when we were children, so things were pretty...
It was pretty messed up for quite a while, and she died when we were 9.
That's a traumatic event.
It was a traumatic event, and it made more so by the decision to never, ever talk about it.
Yeah. Wow.
So we didn't talk about it. You know, it was difficult. But I do have to say this about our dad. He had to go to work when he was 14 because he was sort of really helping support his family in New York. So he had to go to night school starting at the age of 14. And he really went to night school.
And you said his dad died when he was
1 year
old.
And his stepfather had, you know, alcohol problems. And for most of his young life, he worked for General Motors as a runner. And he put himself through high school, through college. And he always said
that's pretty amazing at that time.
Yeah, and he always said he at Cooper Union he did the 4 years and he did so well he was invited back for a fifth year. Yeah. But anyway, but he almost completed a doctorate actually. But he believed in education and really beat that into us. Yeah. I mean, not physically
at the boxing ring.
Right. Yeah. Well, the thing is, so whenever we got our report cards from school, we had to line up outside the office of his door and explain the grades.
Why'd you get a bad grade in obedience?
Yeah. Or self-control.
Self-control.
But this, in our family, education was highly prized. And now the thing is, I must admit, I was a much better student than Dermot.
That's true. I will not deny this.
Yeah, right. So very few things that he's honest about. this is one of them. The thing is, because I enjoyed virtually every class I ever took here at the University of Alaska and in graduate school, University of Washington, even if it wasn't that enjoyable, you know, I just found something to like
well,
about it.
Well, I mean, but the
Dermot
the,
had less patience, I think, sometimes. Maybe.
Well,
I think that's true, Dermot.
So,
I think so.
Yeah. So Terrence got his degree in geography and in Northern Studies.
Which well, the geography part caused great amusement for my dad because, he thought it was a few cuts above Scrimshaw, but not greatly.
And,
you know, the whole joke is, what's
weaving.
The capital of North Dakota?
That's basket weaving and Scrimshaw.
Oh, basket weaving and Scrimshaw. Yeah, right.
But the real value at the UAF in the 70s when we were both here is small classes. It was inexpensive, and the ability to know your professors, your instructors.
It's been observed that, you know, in America, one of the great abilities you have is to reinvent yourself. And in some ways, Alaska typifies that. When you come up to a place like Fairbanks, suddenly the possibilities seem to open up, and the sort of restrictions or expectations that you might have carried down among your family or where you were born don't apply so much, and suddenly you can sort of forge a path that you call your own. Did you find that to be the case?
I think that's absolutely true, and it really does fit in the bigger part of that the education system is so forgiving, that as many parts of the society were, of people allowing to have second and third and sixth chances, the possibility of reinvention is one of the great things of actually going to college. And it is a time of opportunity for people to choose paths that they want, which is one of the reasons why I find it so distressing thinking of college now and university, that you're a customer, that you're going to the store and buying. That's not what it should be really at all. Really, it's an exploration. And I think sort of for both of us, that was really too. Dermot found journalism. He sort of wandered into that. You know, he edited the Polar Star, which was the student newspaper then. And I got interested in geography, but also history and writing. So we both came to sort of writing, but different ways.
Through different avenues.
Yeah.
Well,
and
let me
break that
apart here for a second. Sure. Let's start with you then, Terrence. What drew you to history? Who engaged your enthusiasm or imagination for that?
Well, in 1974, Bill Hunt, who was my mentor really in the history department, he was the wonderful professor for me and a lifelong friend, and still see him every year. He published his book North of 53, which was a history of the gold rushes to Alaska, and that's a period that I've always been very fascinated by, partly because of the parallels with the construction of the pipeline in those days, but I just love the gold rush stories, and that book sort of really inspired me to think, well, gosh, I'd like to be a writer, but I don't know anything to write about, but heck, I could write about this. So I just kind of wandered into it with no vision at all, except that I loved history and I loved figuring out mysteries and stories and stuff. And I think that is that I'm just a little bit more patient than Dermot in one sense, but I'm a lot slower than he is, you know.
Well, your deadlines are different, aren't they?
Well, I've never met a deadline in my life, Robert. I'm very proud of that fact, you know. And of course, being a historian, it's been, I think I read in one survey, it was the least stressful job probably in America, being a historian. You know?
Right. And I think journalism is one of the most stressful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
I'm going to come back to your graduate work down at University of Washington in a minute, but let's go over to you. So journalism, what drew you to that?
Well, I kind of veered into what this is Terrence's term, political ha-ha science. So I studied political science for And I never consciously thought that the Watergate scandal was my reason for getting interested in journalism, but it happened at the same time. And I really became interested in tales about newspapers. So I read a lot about histories of newspapers, and every good one that I could find I read, and that sealed it for me. And I didn't know how to write at all. And I remember just with the bitter struggle it was to write, first thing I'd ever came up with for print, it took me 7 or 8 hours to write 3 or 4 paragraphs. So it took a long time. It took me several years where I wasn't anxious about that. I mean, it still is difficult, and it still requires mental concentration. But my goal was, and this sounds crazy now, never make a factual mistake. And I still, after I made a few hundred or thousand, I realized that maybe that was a little bit impractical, but still you make the effort to get things right. And so that maybe that's how I came to it.
Well, and for me in history, the same thing, I would rewrite. I mean, when I first started, it's just like Dermot, I didn't know how to write. I would hear other students talk about writing term papers. And I thought, God, how do they do that? They're talking like it's so dang easy. Dermot, though, I think said the right thing, that university, the key thing about it is largely self-education. I mean, you need a few mentors and guides along the way. That's absolutely essential. No one really has ever taught anything. It's not a passive activity. It's an active activity. It's not so much teaching as learning.
Well, you became an editor of a historical journal.
Well, that's true. I worked for Alaska Northwest Publishing for quite a few years, and that taught me a lot about writing. I've always enjoyed Strunk and White, The Elements of Style. In the later version, Rule 17 is omit needless words, or O-N-W. And I know that was sort of ridiculed, but the Hemingway belief that you leave the words out, but I think there's a terrific power in the unspoken message that you actually get your writing to speak. And Dermot is really good about that, too.
And the way you learn how to write is by is doing it
over and over again. Dermot has written more about Fairbanks, Alaska than any human being in the history of the world. Well, that goes back to Moses and Solomon and all those smart guys, too. As far as I know, they never wrote about Fairbanks, Alaska.
But so much of it was the same thing over and over again. That's the problem.
Of course, the two of us together, I mean, I've added a little bit, too, in my book about the history of Fairbanks. But I think what makes him such a good writer is that struggle to say it differently each time.
But writing has got to be a continual effort. If you think it's coming easy to you, then it's not. You're not trying hard enough.
I don't know if Samuel Johnson or whoever said that, you know, the easy writing is bad reading. And Dermot's always been a model. Virtually every time I read his stuff, I think, oh, man, this is good. This was really a great.
And I have to say this, you know, I got the ideas for most of my books came from Terrence.
I know you guys talk pretty regularly and you kind of hash over historical and topical questions. What's the exchange? How do you guys talk about things together?
It's usually kind of an argument.
Yeah, but I give him the good ideas, you know. That's basically sort of it. And all these people think I'm him, usually.
But I must say that we have sort of similar views on a lot of things, particularly on writing. Yeah. And I've been sort of an amateur historian. He's sort of a professional.
That's Dermot and Terrence Cole. When we return from the break, a passion for teaching. This is Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Let's return to our conversation. Anybody who's taken a class from you will talk about your lively, engaged style. You really do seem to bubble with ideas. That spark, that intellectual fizz, is what a university should be.
I think the goal of the university is to sort of inspire people. And I know I'm not the smartest person around. I'm very hardworking, but I have a lot of enthusiasm. And it's the thing is that humor is really the key element for me because it keeps people off guard. The brain, in a way, likes to be challenged, and you don't know what's coming next. So largely, I would set the classes up so that people didn't know what I was going to do next. Now, this is sometimes a problem when you forget what you're going to do next, which was sometimes what happened to me. I get so carried off in the bit that I was doing. But I always told people, well, you know, if they come to my class, I'll work you into the act. Teaching is a lot like acting in the sense that you have to keep the audience engaged. And so I would think of the students as both students and an audience. Because if they're asleep, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are, and you need to keep them provoked. I love thinking about the world and humor, which I think is the saving grace of humans. At least it is for me. Because, you know, I've been diagnosed with cancer, and it's very difficult because it is a very hard thing. My cancer isn't curable. And I was just telling one of my good friends, Dirk Turtoff, he pointed this out to me. I said, well, Dirk, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to live. And he said, well, that's everybody's story. And then I thought it was a great example, sort of a memory. I mean, the only thing is that the odds are I'm not going to live as long as either of you two guys. I mean, that's the odds. But I think that to me, humor has been one of the defining things of my life, both as a writer and a teacher, because trying to come up with a way of saying something that's got a twist in it. For instance, I'm working on this book, trying to finish this last book of mine. It's a Gold Rush story, and I've thought of this lead. It took me a long time, but it was about George Carmack, who was the alleged to be discoverer of the Klondike Goldfields. And so his name was George Washington Carmack, but George Carmack was sometimes known as Lying George because he wasn't on a first-name basis with the truth. But anyway, so the lead is this. No one ever said that George Washington Carmack could not tell a lie. And I thought, now that's a good sentence. It hooks you, and it's also funny. And then I said, you know, it was hardly his sterling reputation for truthfulness that earned him the nickname Lying George, etc. Yeah. So then you go on, but that issue of humor in the writing, Dermot hasn't been able to do this in journalism so much, even though he does have a really good sense of humor, but the restrictions on a journalist are much different than a university professor. And so I've been allowed to get away with a lot more, and also my writing in books and stuff. So
somewhere in Plato's Symposium, he talks about two offspring, ideas and your actual children. And I know family is important for both of you. You both have wonderful, amazing kids. And you've both produced a lot of literature and ideas.
Well, listen, Robert, I'm this is Dermot. I don't think anything that I've written is literature at all. Really don't. Not at all. But the history books Terrence has done do qualify as that.
Well, I don't know about literature.
Particularly the E.T. Barnett book is a great biography of E.T. Barnett. Those were really worked well over. He spent thousands of hours on them. Those do qualify as great Alaska literature as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think the thing is that, and I've always told people, I write mostly for myself. I think if I can amuse myself and I like this, that I will do it. You know, and it really is true. I mean, I joke about it, but I don't think I ever have met a deadline for anything.
His book on C.W. Snedden and the fight for Alaska statehood, that was, let's put it this way,
several years overdue.
Several years, yeah. I mean, it had the gestation period of several elephants.
Well, do you know Douglas Adams' comment? He loves deadlines. He loves the lovely whooshing noise they make as they pass by.
That's right. Okay, that's a good joke.
And that's the difference between having in newspaper work, you have to get it done or there's a hole in the page and then you won't be there tomorrow.
But don't they say journalist is the first pages of history?
First draft of history.
Yeah.
Well, one time publisher of the Washington Post said that, it's first rough draft of history.
Well, see, I think that is true, that a lot of what Dermot has written is going to be of inestimable value to the future because he took such care with it and did make that effort to sort of get it right. I mean, it is different because we sort of both work on opposite ends of the spectrum in the same profession of trying to make the words come out right and trying to make the book. And, you know, and I always say, well, Dermot's book sold a lot more than mine, you know, but mine have a lot more footnotes. And it is true. I did this book for the, history of the National Bank of Alaska working with the Rasmus family. And I probably shouldn't have done this, but I ended up counting. The book has 1,000 footnotes. And I thought, man, what was wrong with me?
Okay, that is a lot of footnotes, Terrence. But the I do remember, in this case, that book on the history of the National Bank of Alaska is actually the only thorough economic history of Alaska. And the footnotes are invaluable for anyone studying the economy of Alaska.
You both have written about the university and about the town of Fairbanks. That history now indelibly contains the name Cole. I mean, you can't think about it between you and Pat and Terrence. All of you have contributed. There must be a certain satisfaction to know that you've made a difference.
Well, I think that's right. I think that it also, as we've gotten older, and because we lived in the same town for so long, and it's enormously enriched my life, Dermot and his wife, Debbie, are really my closest friends. What's come across to me, though, is how everything is really fleeting, ultimately, in life. And it's like a contribution to try and do your best. And I think I've always tried that, and I know Dermot has tried that. And we've probably failed more often.
That's a That's right. That's what you need to do in life. You need to try to do your best on whatever it is you're doing. And we've been lucky enough to have a chance to do something we both love doing.
With words.
You know? And I've never figured what I was doing was work. One summer job I had in college, working in a furniture factory in Pennsylvania. And I worked 4 days a week, 10 hours a day. I just remember every day when I went to work, the only thing I thought about was the moment I would get off work and when I would punch out. So I never have thought of my employment in that regard.
Yeah, me neither. And I think initially when the faculty union came in here in the university, I didn't like the idea at all because I thought, well, I'm not a member of the IWW, you know. That's not me,
no,
you know.
The International Workers of the World, right? Or industrial.
What was
the
Well, anyway, industrial, whatever it was.
Never mind. For listeners who don't know,
the one big union.
It was a union in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I agree with Dermot that I never, because it always seemed to me fun, but a little bit is like play, because when my son Henry was little, we bought him a toy typewriter, so he sat next to me. And I have this picture of me working on my Selectric 3 IBM that I bought with my first PFD dividend check, and Henry sitting next to me with his toy typewriter. And Henry used to always say, Daddy, would you not play history anymore? Because
he got tired of playing.
He got tired of playing history. But I never really got tired of it. And I think it's like you, Robert, with on the radio and interviews and the things that you sort of love doing. And just like Dermot said, that and university has been very good to me, you know, really wonderful to me in lots of ways. And I've had excellent colleagues for the most part. I always thought it was such a privilege to get to do this. And then you also get paid, that you get to think about ideas. And so in that way, the newspaper and the university are very similar because it's the life of ideas.
We started off talking really about the value of education. And I think something we're both really proud of is that our kids have seen the value of education.
Yeah, I agree.
Terrence's son, Henry, earned a history degree at UAF. Now, after many years of going to school part-time and working full-time, he's earning an engineering degree. His son, Desmond, is earning a master's in public policy from the University of Michigan.
And Dermot's kids, Connor's getting a PhD in economics.
And then my daughters are both who earn bachelor's degrees. One is just starting nursing school, and the other one is making headway towards that goal. And then, of course, Terrence's daughter, Elizabeth, who's fairly young, is...
She's eight.
Yeah. Eight, yeah. She hasn't decided yet what she wants to study in college.
She's second grade. You know, there's a lot of... Yeah. Doors are closing, though. I got to tell her that.
Somehow, they've picked up on that notion.
Yeah.
Right? And they didn't have any boxing lessons either.
Yeah, there was no boxing.
That's the thing we missed was we forgot about that.
Yeah.
No boxing
lessons. Dang, we really, screwed up in the parenting angle. Yeah. One thing that's really interesting is that because we're identical twins, our kids are basically half brothers and sisters, you know, and there are lots of similarities between...
Yeah, they are similar. That's true. Yeah.
I mean, I have three children and Dermot has three children. In a way, it's like there are six brothers and sisters of the six of them, and they really are all nice people. And that's the main thing, that they're nice kids.
Yeah. You know what? That's a lot more important than worldly accomplishments.
Yeah.
Right. Awards are not very important. Although Terrence got big awards. He got both the Usabelli Award and the Bullock Award, which are the two university awards. And with one of them, I think he set up a scholarship for Bill Hunt, right? Wait a minute. It's not a scholarship for Bill Hunt. It's a scholarship in Bill Hunt's name for history students, right?
Right. I think that being able to help, and we have one that we founded initially in our dad's name, and then we added Pat, so we just said we called it the Cole Family Scholarship. It really was a thing of paying back and helping young students. That's one thing that I really am proud of.
That's Terrence Cole from a discussion I had with him and his twin brother Dermot last year. Terrence's achievements are lauded in a new volume of essays called The Big Wild Soul of Terrence Cole from the University of Alaska Press. When we return from this break, we'll hear the second part of our conversation, including coping with cancer. Welcome back to this encore discussion I had with the twins Terrence and Dermot Cole. University of Alaska Press just issued a volume of essays saluting Terrence's life and work. When I talked with the twins last spring, they were in a time of transition. Terrence was undergoing cancer treatment and was retiring from UAF. Dermot had just started a blog, continuing his examination of Alaska's social and political landscape that found expression in newsprint for decades. I began the second part of our conversation by asking Dermot about the blog.
Yeah, well, the blog started just because
what's the name of the blog? What's the address of that?
DermotGold.com. Yeah, and the Daily News Miner has started picking up some of those entries. They're just mainly things that I wanted to say, not for everyone, but it's something that I wanted to say. I guess the point I was trying to get at when I started originally in this work, I started in 1976, and my thought was I would be here 1 year, and then I wanted to be a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. You know, that was pretty unrealistic. But
it's like that E.B. White thing. Remember,
he would be in his apartment, and he would go one block from his apartment to go to the East.
Yeah,
right?
Because
and
he was always
letter for the East,
and he was jealous of all those foreign correspondents,
and he didn't want to go anywhere either. So, yeah. But it took me several years. But I began slowly to understand that I could learn what I needed to learn here, at least for me, for my particular skills and inclinations, and I liked living in Fairbanks.
Well, it's no small feat to be a chronicle of any place.
Yeah, well, and I've enjoyed it. I left here for 1 year. I went to work for the Associated Press in Seattle, worked there for 1 year, and what really drove me off the cliff there was when I had to do the overnight shift, meaning from 11 o'clock at night till 7 in the morning, while I had two young kids who were wide awake in the morning. So that
they weren't really in tune with the news cycle.
Yeah, yeah, right. In their case, news never sleeps.
It was literally cases, true.
So
it was
and
true.
The AP, his idea was to rewrite the ball scores rewrite the weather report.
So I'd have to take phone calls from a radio station, some small town in Washington, looking for the PCL standings, you know, Pacific Coast League standings. And it dawned on me eventually, wow, I really preferred working in Fairbanks, where I was dealing with people I knew. Had more of a chance to be the original or make more of a difference. So we came back, and I never regretted coming back here.
And
it was in 1989.
You also went down to Seattle to work and write Northwest books and et cetera. What brought you back?
Well, I got my PhD at the University of Washington, and I enjoyed my time in Seattle, but it never was as much fun, graduate school, even though I had lots of fun in graduate school, as being an undergraduate here, and I really miss that, the excitement of an adventure. Because one thing I always like to say about with Alaska history is just as wide open the field has other opportunities in Alaska. You know, you could just take a dart and throw it over your shoulder and find a topic that had been
unresearched
and unwritten about. And it's still true today.
And he was always trying to come back here. And it was I think you started in 88 at the history department.
Yeah, I came back to the University of Alaska in 88. And it's been, this is the 30th year, my 30th year here. And I am so incredibly lucky, you know, that I got to come back. And because also, you know, Dermot and Patrick lived here and their children and stuff, and I really felt much more at home here. Even though, you know, I enjoyed Seattle a lot. You know, there were lots of things. There was a great library and stuff, but not – and I've always said, you know, I'm so lucky I got to work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks because I don't think my style would necessarily fit in at most other universities. You know, they don't there's just a – the great line I quote in my book on the university, the guy said, you know, the average students you meet were not the 9 out of 10 people you'd meet on the street, this guy said in the 1940s. They were mostly number 10. So I've often, when I give talks in the university, sometimes it's 9 out of 10 or not 9 out of 10. I used to say 9 out of 10. I think, wait, that's wrong. I got the guy's quote wrong. But anyway, so I did come back here, and I felt so sort of like Dermot that it was just great to, because you could have a big impact in Fairbanks if you stick around long enough. Though I often point out to people when they were bragging about how long they've been around town, you know, I mean, you know, E.T. Barnett was less than 10 years here, you know, of course, then he got run out of town, you know, so it might have been a little bit longer. If that hadn't happened, you know, a slight indiscretion with
the banking. If the bank had not failed.
Yeah. The clever, like they say, or intricate accounting principles. but it's not much. It's both a combination of the fact that there were opportunities here and that we were so excited about it. But one thing I always remember in 1974, when Bill Egan was running against Jay Hammond, and we went down to meet him. Remember, were you there?
The stake pit.
Yeah, the stake pit.
Which was on the old Steese Highway near where, across from Century Hardware.
Yeah. And it was...
Where that mall is now.
Yeah. So what was interesting was Egan
was
there.
It was a fundraiser for Bill Egan.
Bill Egan. But he was smoking, not like a chimney.
Yeah,
he was smoking like a power plant, you know. Yeah. And I thought, man, this guy was the first governor of Alaska, president of the Alaska Constitutional Convention, and we got to meet him
and talk with him. He came over and he sat down at our table, Terrence, me, and Pat.
And then I thought, well, this is the governor of Alaska, and, you know, and even though we were young, and we never got to meet the governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And I also remember we met Gravel, because I worked on the McGovern campaign in 1972, which was not very successful as far as political campaigns go. And I was so surprised that Nixon won. I thought, geez, I thought McGovern had a chance. So it wasn't, you know, maybe I have taken more political science classes, I would have, you know, would have had a clue. But I remember Gravel came down there. I thought, gosh, this guy is our U.S. senator. And might have met Nick Begich. I can't remember before his... Who's deaf that year or so.
Well, you know, I do remember that one thing about the thing with Egan. Now, this is weird, right? I think he was smoking Benson and Hedges cigarettes. He emptied his pack, and so I kept the empty pack for, I don't know. I eventually threw it away, but I kept it for like 20, 30, because I thought it was important. This was the governor's pack of cigarettes. And, you know, and it was said that Egan could remember everybody's name. And I don't really know if that's true, but he had a...
he didn't remember our names because I think, you know, he was...
Yes, but that's a good anecdote about how you can...
Personal nature of Alaska.
Yeah. You're not just... You don't have to be lost in the crowd.
Right.
That remains true today. You know, people may not listen to you and you may have nothing to say, but you can at least...
You can at least say it.
Make yourself heard.
Job.
Well, I think it's so interesting that you both have produced books. You both appreciate that venture.
Yeah. I've enjoyed the same kind of work, same process, just on a different speed, really, because of deadlines.
And also, I'm a little more thoughtful than he is, Robert. Let's face it.
It's a lot more thoughtful. It's not just footnotes,
yeah. But it's being thoughtful.
Yeah.
But I think it is a different speed. I think that's right. That's interesting. It's just the freedom that being working at a university has given me. I've had more freedom than Dermot. But he's had an advantage in some ways because he's written a lot more than I have. And I think that, actually, though, that's one thing, because I think even a lot of the people who didn't necessarily agree with Dermot would respect his thoroughness and judiciousness of trying to be even-handed, because he really is... good
well,
at being even-handed.
Unlike
me.
Occasionally.
I mean, I am not even-handed at all. I have opinions on everything, and I'm willing to share them. And in a way, a reporter is like a judge. You're not really supposed to be out there arguing for one client or another. Though even in history, it's the same thing. I would say, you know, you can't be a prosecuting attorney or a defense attorney. You have to be more like a judge or a member of a jury. So I think that's the professional responsibility of a historian or a journalist, is that try and see both sides. And he does really, and it's much more difficult in current events because the passions are so heated at the time, you know.
We could go on and on about this, but it turns out that using reason most of the time doesn't convince people. Most of the time people, A, don't want to shift their position, and B, emotions play a huge role in convincing people one way or another. And for, I think, all three of us, that's staggering to consider, because you think reason should be a guiding principle in human interaction and behavior.
Yeah, I do think you have to accept that that's not going to work.
Yeah. Robert, I think that's exactly correct. Our little rational part of our brain is riding on a giant elephant of emotion, and the elephant's going to go where it wants, and even the reason, often it's not going to be there. And I think that is a difficult thing for scientists and scholars sometimes to accept, even though they also, we also are susceptible to it as writers, as students, as trying to be as objective-minded as we can. But I think you're absolutely correct that's the beauty of humans, and it's also the great drawback of our natures, is that the emotions play such a giant role, and irrationality is so powerful a force with us.
So powerful. But I want to just point out once again, you know, I sound like a broken record, but when you write a book, you write a document that gives a permanent form, a permanent shape, and it may get superseded by facts that come down the line, or other people might come in and say, well, that interpretation of the facts is different. But you've given a form, an enduring container to some of your experience. They will always have your books. And any old-time recordings we've got on file here. So that'll always be the document that...
Yeah, great. Yeah. That's something you want to really
telling
highlight.
Telling me to shut up when I'm making an impolitic joke. Like, I remember, I thought this was a good gag. When we did the Any Old Time Show 1 year, I said, come on, strike a blow against the Taliban because they didn't like music. Maybe it wasn't a good joke.
But I think you're right about that with the books, right? You're right about it. And
the interesting thing is that I heard an author one time interview in The New Yorker who referred to his books on the shelf as his colleagues. And when you make your contribution to the literature, that you're in a conversation across the ages. So that is a kind of, I think, a nice thing that we've made a contribution to at least this little small part of the universe here. I like the idea of being in the conversation with people even after you're gone. When you have a longer frame of time reference, because our lives are also short, that's the best we can do, is just put our little piece into the conversation before we have to leave the stage.
That's Terrence Cole, and this is Northern Soundings. When we return, Frank, reflections on cancer. This is Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Production of Northern Soundings is made possible in part by support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This segment, I'm continuing my discussion with Dermot and Terrence Cole. As I mentioned, Terrence is facing treatment for gastric cancer. I asked him about his condition and how physicians are addressing the disease.
As I've learned a lot about cancer, more than I ever wanted to probably, but I've learned through this process what chemotherapy does. The chemotherapy kills the fast-growing cells. And the interesting thing is it's so indeterminate. Chemotherapy is like if your goal was to stop bank robberies, you shoot everyone who's going in or out of the bank. And that
quickly,
way the bank...
Quickly.
Yeah, quickly. And that way there will be no bank robberies. Now, the problem is there's a lot of blood stains on the floor that as a left because of that. So it's amazing that cancer is such an unusual disease. And the interesting thing is that unlike some other diseases, you know, the doctors really don't know how long you're going to live. Anything they're going to say about stuff like that is almost always wrong. So they try to be truthful, but vague. And I've always been a pretty good planner. The mystery is not just from disorganization. It's just that people actually don't know. And it is a little bit taboo, which is why I like to joke about it. Because when people say, well, I heard about your diagnosis, and they don't want to say cancer. And I like saying it, and I like just facing it. Well, this is what I've got, and I am trying to have a good sense of humor about it. And mostly I do. Some days are much harder than others, but it's taught me a lot about life. And I'm so grateful to my family and to Dermot and to Debbie and my sister Maureen, who sort of helped take care of me. Though as one other person in the cancer club told me, she said, well, don't you hate being so damn grateful? And I said, well, yeah, that's true. You know, you don't want to be grateful all the time, but you want to have an attitude of gratitude, like people say. And I really do. That's helped me a lot and maintain my sense of humor about this, because I've been so lucky in my life. You know, I've been lucky to have a twin brother. And the reality is, Dermot and I have a very close bond, and like all identical twins. And I know what he thinks about most things before him ever telling me. I just know. That's why I said, and I say, I'm glad, though, it's me and not him, because it would be very hard for me to see him have cancer. And I'm not afraid of dying, because I just think essentially it's like going to sleep. But I'm sad to leave my loved ones behind, you know. And I think, oh, you know, there's other fun things I'd like to do. But people always feel that they don't have enough time. And that's the human condition. So I guess the thing is that being, you know, in the cancer club, it does set you apart from other people, because your calendar is different, even though, and it's full of question marks, even though that's everyone's calendar. It's just that they're not aware of it. They don't think about it. For my family and loved ones, it's a chance to say goodbye and to come out of a deeper appreciation and recollection of your life. So as of yet, I don't feel any pain at all. And I've had the disease probably for a year now. Mainly what I feel is the chemotherapy, because the chemotherapy is pretty awful. And in the future, I'm convinced of this. Cancer will ultimately be a very easy disease at the microbiological level to tackle once that secret is unlocked. So
you mean the genetics?
The genetics, yes, genetics. And because once you're able to turn those cells off, that's going to happen. And, you know, who knows when it'll be. It won't be in time for me, but it's something that, as a historical thing, it's interesting. It's like I've got some medieval disease almost, because we're going to look back upon this as a medieval-like treatment almost. But I've been lucky, for the doctors are very caring, and I've got really great medical care here in Fairbanks and also back in New York City. Like I tell my kids, that's the thing I miss the most. I miss the fact that I can't be around longer to see my children and Dermot's children more, and particularly my young daughter, Elizabeth, who's only 8 years old, who basically is the age we were when our mother died. So that weighs heavy on me, actually. And so I've tried to think about writing a book to her, and it's very difficult. But all in all, I'm mostly grateful that I have a lot of people helping me, and like that I got to do this last class with Mary Erlander, Dr. Erlander, one of my dearest friends, and that, like, Michelle Bartlett of Summer Session, she's arranged for me to give this last lecture. And as Dermot's wife Debbie said, just because it be my last lecture doesn't mean I'm going to stop pontificating about everything, or lecturing small l. I think she said last lecture is two capital last in lecture. But I'm looking forward to doing that, because I just want to say thank you, and to remember, I've had so much fun doing this. It's just like Dermot said, I never felt like I was going to work. Never. I mean, some days are more stressful than others, you know, but boy, the fun I've had of getting to do things, and the way I've been able to use humor to teach a subject that a lot of people don't, you know, because history can be quite grim. The humor has helped me a lot in both teaching and writing, and now dealing with cancer. Like, for instance, I've worried about many things in my life, but I never, ever, 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 ever worried about getting gastric cancer. Not a single time. It's just so funny.
So it was a complete surprise.
Oh, total surprise. It's a very rare cancer in the West, quite common in Japan. But like I said, I'm grateful, because, gosh, I felt so much love and appreciation from people, and seeing my former students. I'm just really moved by it. And I've gotten hundreds of letters, and I almost have a perfect record in not answering a single one, because I just don't have it in me, really, to answer sure. them. But it means so much to me if people wrote. So even though there's a sort of a prolonged sadness that you know, you just have to endure with this, there's also sort of a prolonged joy, because not many people get to feel that. I'm embarrassed about it a lot, you know, because I really don't like to, you know, like, I don't like to hear myself on the radio. Like, I would never want to listen to this recording of making with you, just because I think, God, I sound like such an idiot, you know. And
I can edit that out.
Can you
just take out the bad parts?
Yeah, right. Take all the bad parts and make it look good. But anyway, in a way, having this disease, that's given me this odd joy, which is really weird.
Because so many people don't have that ability to experience that kind of love and care and concern, and that's a gift.
Oh, absolutely. And also because I think it's all sort of funny, you know, having this, because I just think everything is funny. And I've always thought that there's something funny in virtually every human encounter. And in this one, I just try and remember that.
Well, I want to ask Dermot, this must be a very difficult process for you, but you're there for your brother. Have you learned anything through this process?
Well, it is really difficult. And tell you the truth, I've just tried not to think very far ahead. You know, you just sort of think in the moment. That's what I'm
And
thinking.
Me too. That's what I, yeah.
That's maybe the best way of handling this. Maybe a greater appreciation for the moment that you exist in.
Sure, I can imagine.
Because I think, Robert, that because really I can think a few days or a few weeks ahead. And that was one of the things I wanted to say, is that even though my students may have thought me disorganized, I've always loved planning and anticipating future. And a person can't write a book even without some level of planning. And that's right. And I've often told my students and my fellow writers, I say, well, writing a book is like rowing a rowboat across the ocean. You know, some days must be dark and dreary, as Longfellow said. It just seems interminable, but you have to keep rowing. That's the whole thing. You've got to keep pushing on. And some people say, well, why are you working on this? And right now, you know, the days that I can work on my book, I feel really good. You know, and I think, oh, I got a really good sentence today or a couple of paragraphs because I'm really slow. I've sometimes reworked a paragraph 50 or 100 times. And some of that's just obsessive compulsive craziness because it doesn't necessarily get better between the, you know, the 59th time.
It's 50 times better.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily get any better. And I write out loud. I always read everything out loud because, you know, I write with my ears because I don't know any of the rules of grammar, which always used to bother my teacher Klaus Nasky, who knew where to put all the commas. I don't know where they go, but I do know if it sounds right. So in that sense, to me, writing is like music. I'm not a musician, and I couldn't drop a tune. But I think it's the music of language and writing, which is the beautiful, fun part. And to get a sentence just right, I've always thought, well, that's one of the most great pleasures. The wonderful thing about teaching is that teaching keeps me more sane, because as a writer, you're too much in your head. And teaching meant I'd have interactions with other people, like with the students. One thing is, ultimately, you don't have any control over what the students are really going to take away, because it's up to them to pick up the load and carry it. It's their job, you know. You can lay it out, but they have to shoulder the burden, really, of what they're going to take away. But in writing, it's not that way. In writing, you have control, and you really can get a level of perfection and getting it right with writing that you can't do with teaching, because you're more in control. So as a writer, one of the things about that I don't like about cancer is that it's robbed me of the ability of thinking months ahead, or that rowing that rowboat across the ocean. I'm thinking, geez, I'm never gonna get to Baja. You know, at this rate, you know.
Especially if you're going to the Atlantic.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. So I'm just keep rowing just the way I've always done it and get as far as I can. That's my sort of goal. But anyway, Dermot, I'm really grateful that you set this up. And
it's great
grateful.
To have him. Yeah. Terrence and Dermot Cole, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Robert.
Links to my discussion with Dermot and Terrence Cole and the new volume of Terrence Cole's professional and personal contributions can be found at northernsoundings.com or the Northern Soundings page at KUAC.org. I'm Robert Hannon. Let me wish you a joyous new year, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.